The Harvard Slavery Report on General George Washington. This is a podcast of EarlyHarvard.com by A.J. Melnick. This is a follow-on podcast prepared in response to Harvard University's official April 2022 report titled Harvard and the Legacy of Slavery, a work which has received wide attention. While the report makes some important contributions about Harvard and slavery, as previous podcasts and articles have documented, its slipshod and incomplete approach to both American history in general and Harvard's own history significantly denigrate its credibility. It is distorted and heavily interspersed with woke propaganda. The authors of the report clearly made no efforts to be comprehensive or even fair in their treatment of historical events. Such is certainly the case when it comes to George Washington and the history of Harvard and slavery. The report mentions Washington only once, and only in respect to a very brief conversation he is said to have had with a little 6-year-old black boy named Darby Vassell. This interaction occurred soon after General Washington arrived in Massachusetts to take command of the Continental Army. While we do learn a little about Darby from the report, even his life story is woefully incomplete in the report. Meanwhile, in a report that is ostensibly about Harvard and slavery, the authors completely missed one of the most important stories of all. But we didn't, and we will discuss it here. The setting was as follows. It had been some 2 weeks since the first shots of the American Revolution were fired at Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775. The colonies in Great Britain were now in a state of undeclared war. Ordinary people were choosing sides. Those who sided with the British were called Loyalists or Tories, while those who sided with the American cause became known as Patriots. One very ardent patriot was the Reverend Samuel Langdon, who had been installed as the 13th president of Harvard the year before, in 1774. Langdon himself was a Harvard graduate, having received his bachelor's degree in 1740 and his master's degree in 1743. Early on, he began to serve as a chaplain to the Continental Army. Prior to Washington's arrival on the scene, Langdon delivered a sermon to the assembled American troops on May 21, 1775, on the Cambridge Common, just a little over a month after the battles at Lexington and Concord. Earlier, on May 1st, Langdon had dismissed Harvard students for an early summer vacation. The college was then temporarily relocated in the town of Concord. Classes did not resume until October in what has been termed Harvard's Year of Exile. Meanwhile, the Harvard campus itself was transformed into a military camp for the Continental Army. At the end of that month, on May 31, 1775, the Reverend Langdon addressed the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts in a sermon titled Government Corrupted by Vice. With a few minor edits, here's what Langdon proclaimed to the Massachusetts Provincial Congress. Quote, "We must keep our eyes fixed on the supreme government of the Eternal King as directing all events, setting up or pulling down the kings of the earth at his pleasure. We have rebelled against God. We have lost the true spirit of Christianity, though we retain the outward profession and form of it. We have neglected the glorious gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ and his holy commands and institutions. That for the sins of a people God may suffer, that is, allow, the best government to be corrupted or entirely dissolved, and that nothing but a general reformation can give ground to hope that the public happiness will be restored." End quote. Langdon's stirring words at this critical moment in American history can easily be applied to our own day as well. George Washington's arrival in Cambridge. A little over a month after this, on July 2, 1775, after an 8-day journey from New York City to cheering crowds along the way, George Washington and his aides arrived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to take command of the American forces. Their arrival came on the heels of the bloody Battle of Bunker Hill, which had taken place just 2 weeks earlier on June 17th. Washington spent that first night in Cambridge in President Langdon's home. The next morning, he reviewed the sorry state of the Continental Army, which he found shocking. According to one account, men continued to pour in, quote, "from all directions, from different colonies, with no system in place for how to organize or feed them, with groups spread out in disorganized encampments over a stretch of several miles, without sanitation or running water. Everything was in a general state of disorder." Washington then decided to set up his headquarters in the former home of British loyalist John Vassell, who had fled Cambridge. This home, which many years later became the residence of famed American poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, is just a short walk from Harvard Yard. The Darby Vassal Story. This brings us up to the Darby Vassal story and the only mention of George Washington in the Harvard Slavery Report. The section in the report is strangely titled, quote, Darby Vassal and Black Resistance, end quote. Darby himself was a fascinating person. The son of parents Tony and Cuba Vassal, they carried the last name of their former owner, just mentioned, John Vassal. They had all been left behind when the Vassals fled New England. 6-year-old Darby was reportedly swinging on the front gate of the mansion when General Washington entered the property. However, the first article published about this episode didn't appear until some 10 years after Darby's death in October 1861. And it appears to have gotten some of the main details wrong. At any rate, we will accept the story at face value for purposes of our discussion. According to Washington biographer Ron Chernow, Washington, in a, quote, friendly manner, expressed interest in taking Darby into his service, end quote. But instead of seeing this as an opportunity, little Darby responded by asking how much he would be paid. At that interjection, notes Chernow, Washington evidently lost interest. The whole episode probably lasted less than 30 seconds. Nevertheless, years later, as a result of this briefest of interactions between an adult and child, Darby would reportedly make the claim that, quote, Washington was no gentleman to expect a boy to work without wages, end quote. Well, to begin with, the entire incident is somewhat questionable as an historical memory. That's not to say it didn't happen, but whatever did happen is of minor interest. What is most remarkable is that the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, during a time of war, would even take the time to speak and interact with a 6-year-old. Washington was probably reaching down and graciously offering this formerly enslaved child an opportunity to help him or simply being kind to him. End of story. This certainly had nothing at all to do with Washington being a gentleman or not, which is an absurdity. As an adult, though, Darby apparently relished retelling this story. However, it belongs in the category of those Washington slept here types of stories. A little child's reaction is certainly not an example of so-called black resistance. Nevertheless, the fact that Darby's childhood story is repeated in the Harvard Slavery Report and that this is the only mention of George Washington seems curious. The authors apparently wanted to use even this tiny event as an opportunity to defame Washington, or at the very least to say, not to avoid saying anything positive about him. It's important to understand this motivation as we dig deeper into all of this. Darby's somewhat bizarre characterization of Washington as allegedly not being a gentleman doesn't take away anything from Darby himself. As an early champion for civil rights, he was an extraordinary individual in his own right. Darby died in 1861, and the report states that he was, quote, buried at his own request with his parents' former enslavers in the Vassal family tomb. It is located under Christ Church near the place of his birth and within sight of Harvard Yard, end quote. As a free man in adulthood, he was a strong advocate for the abolition of slavery. But instead of seeing this primarily as a struggle for equal rights and justice, the authors of the report, in the jargon of radical pseudo-history, quote all of this as, quote, black resistance, end quote. And while the report's authors employed the theme of black resistance in discussing Darby Vassal, they make no mention of the fact that Darby himself was a Christian. One of his descendants has strongly emphasized the fact that Darby loved the Lord. But in an article titled, Here Lies Darby Vassal, one author asks, why would a free slave wish to be buried in the same tomb as his family's enslaver? Wouldn't he want to get as far away from them as possible? Of course, we don't know the exact reason or reasons for this. There may have been many reasons all wrapped together in a complex bundle. We can't presume to know. But from a Christian perspective, a couple of very strong possible explanations present themselves. These include the beliefs of judgment and redemption. As a believer in the New Testament, Darby would have believed in the resurrection. Therefore, he also believed that there would be a day of judgment. So perhaps he decided that he really wanted to be right there when his family's former enslavers were judged. Or alternatively, perhaps he wanted to be buried in the same place as the family of his former enslavers because he forgave them, and because as a Christian, he believed in redemption. For a long time, we know that he carried a note from Catherine Vassal Russell around with him, in which she had promised him the right to be buried in the Vassal family tomb. This was extremely important to Darby, and it seems to speak more than anything else about possible bonds of tenderness and affection between him and some of the extended Vassal family who remained behind in America. All of this context is lost in the report's neo-Marxist theme of defining Darby Vassal in terms of black resistance. The Army melee in Harvard Yard and George Washington's intervention. As noted, while the authors of the slavery report saw fit to mention little Darby Vassal's initial encounter with George Washington in a report ostensibly about Harvard and the legacy of slavery, they completely failed to notice perhaps the most important story of all. The 2021 book, The Indispensables, by renowned military historian Patrick K. O'Donnell, records how this extraordinary event unfolded. The trouble began with some taunting over military garb or uniforms between two of the groups of soldiers who were then garrisoned in Harvard Yard. Some 1,600 soldiers were living in tents on campus or in college buildings that had been vacated by the students. One group of soldiers from Massachusetts and another from Virginia started throwing snowballs at each other. This eventually erupted into a massive brawl. According to accounts, at least 1,000 men were involved in the actual melee. Imagine the scene of hundreds of American soldiers beating upon each other in the midst of Harvard Yard. O'Donnell makes the scene come alive and shows its larger significance to American history as a whole. But before considering the brawl itself and what sparked it, let's look at one of the main units involved in the melee. Patrick O'Donnell's book centers on a very specific unit and group of men in the Continental Army. These men were from Marblehead, Massachusetts, located north of Boston, and as the book recounts, they saved American forces and the young nation itself again and again, whether at the Battle of Brooklyn, the Battle of Pell's Point, or crossing the Delaware River prior to the decisive Revolutionary War battle at Trenton on Christmas Day, 1776. As O'Donnell notes, their collective actions altered the trajectory of history. They were, quote, men of various races and socioeconomic conditions who came together to defeat one of the greatest armies on the globe and confront the most powerful navy in the world, end quote. Their unity as brothers in arms transcended their diversity as they struggled for liberty, freedom, and a nascent country barely 6 months old. Their regimental leader was John Glover, and his unit consisted of, quote, a fully integrated unit of Latin, white, black, and Native American troops, and at least one Jewish member, end quote. These were men who had trained closely together on the high seas before the war. According to regimental rolls, it is assessed that some 20% of the men were non-white. Glover himself came to be quickly trusted by Washington, who then asked Glover's adjutant, Captain Caleb Gibbs, to take on one of the most sensitive duties of all, establishing Washington's Life Guard, the precursor to today's U.S. Secret Service. And where was this done? Well, right in front of where little Darby Vassal lived, the Vassal House, on March 12, 1776. One can imagine little Darby possibly looking on from the house or yard as America's first elite unit was being forged. But back to the earlier scene in nearby Harvard Yard. According to Washington Irving's biography of George Washington, a, quote, large party of Virginia riflemen who had recently arrived in camp and were strolling around Cambridge and viewing the collegiate buildings now turned into barracks. They had, quote, a reputation for brawling and lack of discipline, end quote. Their military attire was described as fringed and ruffled hunting garb. The story was told by a young eyewitness named Israel Trask, who, along with his father, were members of the Massachusetts line. The Virginian's dress was the cause of some merriment to the troops from Marblehead, who were mostly Massachusetts fishermen and sailors. They reportedly began cracking jokes about the Virginians. Snowballs soon gave way to blows and fisticuffs, and in less than 5 minutes, according to Trask's account, more than 1,000 combatants had joined in the campus melee. The tumult was described as, quote, worthy of the days of Homer, end quote, according to this version. It must have been quite a sight. It is certain that Harvard Yard has never seen anything quite like it before or since. But was the fighting just about military garb or regional insults? These somehow seem to have been inadequate to explain the fight's intensity. As noted, the regimental rolls show that some 20% of the Marblehead Regiment was non-white. Patrick O'Donnell strongly implies that the issue of race was probably thrown into the mix. As he states, quote, adding to the tension, a few of the Virginians owned slaves, while the Marblehead Regiment contained several free African Americans, end quote. One can imagine how some of the Southerners might have reacted to this, not only from being taunted, which granted might have been enough in itself, but possibly being taunted by free black soldiers who stood their ground and had no fear of them? This might have been an explosive mix and would seem to be a better explanation for the intensity of the fight rather than just simple teasing over appearance or because of a few regional insults. When Washington himself had arrived in Massachusetts in July 1775, he'd gone through his own culture shock at seeing armed black soldiers fighting for the revolutionary cause. One account states that he was, quote, horrified to find among his troops a considerable number of free Negroes, end quote. This was not something that he was at all familiar with from his own experience. His first impulse was to ban blacks from the army, but his New England generals soon convinced him to reverse course, since he was warned that the, quote, free Negroes who have served in this Continental Army are very much dissatisfied at being discarded, end quote. Washington then authorized that former black veterans could enlist, and Congress further stipulated that those enlistments could only be reenlistments. George Washington's and Billy Lee's sudden appearance. So this was the overall situation in Harvard Yard. Given these circumstances, we now return to the snowball fight. The fact that the fight had erupted at all was serious. It held the potential of splitting the army and taking the whole Patriot cause down with it. News of the melee quickly reached the general's ears, and Washington himself now suddenly appeared on the scene, along with his servant, William Billy Lee. According to one account, Washington, without hesitation, threw the bridle of his own horse into his servant's hands, sprang from his seat, and rushed into the thickest of the melee. With a, quote, iron grip, he then grabbed two tall Virginia riflemen by the throat, and keeping them at arm's length, started shaking and cajoling them. In his famous biography of Washington, Washington Irving described the general as, quote, commanding in his serenest moments, but irresistible in his bursts of indignation, end quote, which is what occurred here. Thus, according to this account, quote, revengeful feelings between the different corps of the army were happily prevented, end quote, in Harvard Yard by the commander-in-chief of American forces. A 2017 article states that an exhibit at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia features what has been termed an incredibly realistic tableau that depicts the epic snowball fight that took place in December 1775 in Harvard Yard between Continental Army soldiers from New England and the Mid-Atlantic states. A quote above the tableau states, "Who that was not a witness could imagine that men who came from different parts of the continent, strongly disposed to despise and quarrel with each other, would instantly become one patriotic band of brothers," end quote. Israel Trask's account of this event was written when Trask was at an advanced age. But when the specific event occurred, he was only 10 or 11 years old. He apparently served as a cook and was in the camp at Cambridge with his father at the time, who was a lieutenant in the Continental Army. Later, young Israel went to sea and was captured three times, exchanged twice, and once escaped to a prison ship. Or from a prison ship. He clearly led a life of daring do. Given all the circumstances, we have no reason to doubt the authenticity of his report about Harvard, which was part of his application for a military pension for his service during the Revolutionary War. The authors of the Harvard Slavery Report chose to tell the Darby Vassal story, but not the William Billy Lee story, even though the latter was directly connected to Harvard's history during the American Revolution. In doing so, they also missed a much greater story, a story that goes to the heart of the new nation of the United States of America that was still in the process of being born. Who was William Billy Lee? Some 7 years before the start of the American Revolution in the spring of 1768, William Billy Lee became a teenage house slave, along with his brother Frank, in the Washington household at Mount Vernon, Virginia. He was purchased by George Washington for £61.15 from Mary Smith Ball Lee, the widow of Colonel John Lee of Westmoreland County, Virginia. He soon became Washington's personal valet, responsible for preparing and laying out his master's clothes, and also for combing his hair. During the war, he also had more important duties, including keeping Washington's most important papers organized and secure. He fought by his side in battle. Ron Chernow notes that Lee remained steadfastly at Washington's side throughout the Revolution. John Trumbull's famous painting of Washington, set near West Point in 1776, possibly shows Billy Lee in the background, looking up toward Washington. Washington's stepson, George Washington Parke Custis, once described Billy Lee as a fearless horseman. Custis wrote that William would throw himself almost at length on the animal and rush at full speed through brake or tangled wood in a style at which modern huntsmen would stand aghast, end quote. Why didn't William Billy Lee try to escape or betray Washington? One of the questions that should be asked is, why would someone like William, or Will, also known as Will Lee, simply defect to the British in order to be free? He was clearly a very competent person, and as someone who had to keep up with Washington on a horse through thick and thin, he also had to be very athletic and resourceful. During the siege of Boston, American forces were very close to the British lines. Then, or at many other key points during the war, William Billy Lee could have defected to the British. He held extremely valuable information, so much that his defection might have altered the entire course of the war. Lee had enough inside information at his disposal to fully betray Washington and the American cause, even more so than Benjamin Church, Benedict Arnold, and many other traitors to America. But he did not do so. Given this reality, Kenneth C. Davis speculates, quote, perhaps Washington had re-examined his views of enslaved people because Billy Lee had proven so loyal, end quote. Mary V. Thompson came to the same conclusion when she wrote, quote, Billy Lee showed incredible loyalty to George Washington through 8 years of war, years when Billy could easily have defected to the British, who promised freedom to slaves who came over to their side, end quote. Imagine, she added, how much he knew about the American army, and what kind of damaging information he might have given to them had he defected. But he did not. He stayed true to Washington and to America. Billy Lee had more opportunity than most slaves to escape, but he never did. It is estimated that at least 47 of Washington's and his wife Martha's slaves, some 7% of all the slaves that he and Martha owned and managed, became fugitives at one point or another during his lifetime. So attempting to escape was certainly not something that Will was completely unfamiliar with. Later in the battles in and around New York City in the fall of 1776, Washington, Billy Lee, and the almost defeated Continental Army barely escaped with their lives. It's estimated that over 11,000 Americans perished as prisoners of the British, many held in prison ships under the most appalling conditions. Billy, or also Will Lee, was also at Washington's side a few months after this, during the famous crossing of the Delaware on Christmas night, a scene described at length in the book The Indescribables. Lee may also have been depicted in another famous painting, this one of that event next to the Delaware River. Quote, Billy is thought to be the figure in the middle ground shown from the rear as he helps maneuver a gun wearing a light-colored coat and an orange hat or turban, end quote. Will Lee had a wife and son back in Mount Vernon. We don't know their names, but they are mentioned in a letter to Washington dated December 30, 1775. However, it also appears that during the war, Billy may have become involved with another woman named Margaret Thomas, or Peggy. She was also known as Peggy Lee. She was a free black woman from Philadelphia who became a cook and seamstress for Washington's staff when they were situated in Cambridge. Unlike the complaint of a little six-year-old Darby Vassal, Peggy was actually put on Washington's payroll. Records show that she received payments from October 1776 through April 1779. Billy Lee later asked Washington if Peggy could join them in Mount Vernon, and Washington made efforts to track her down in Philadelphia. She was eventually found but refused to come to Virginia. There may have been various reasons why, but probably one of them was that Virginia remained a slave state. The bond between George Washington and William Billy Lee. The bond between George Washington and William Billy Lee grew to be very deep. Billy Lee was at his side throughout the Revolution from 1775 through 1783, including all the momentous occasions of the Revolutionary War. Washington once wrote to another correspondent about wanting to fulfill one of Billy's requests to him and to not refuse him, seeing, quote, as he has lived with me so long and followed my fortunes through the war with fidelity." End quote. Will had indeed seen Washington both at his moments of glory and also during his darkest hours, from the Battle of Brooklyn, where America's future hung by a hair, to crossing the Delaware, to the frozen nights at Valley Forge. It was Lee who attended to all the general's personal needs as well as special missions, such as being entrusted with his key correspondence. In Washington's will, upon his death, William received immediate freedom and an annuity of $30 during his lifetime. Darby Vassall obtained his freedom very early on. William Billy Lee did not know the taste of freedom himself until many, many years later. Nevertheless, as a free man, Will Lee chose to live out his days at Mount Vernon, where he had his own house and later worked as a shoemaker. His health had deteriorated due to various injuries, but even after Washington's death, Will continued to receive visitors there and eventually became something of a minor celebrity, regaling visitors with stories of the Revolution and America's first president. One of those visitors was Charles Wilson Peel, who'd known the Washingtons well for 30 years. He stopped by to see Billy in the spring of 1804. Another was a British visitor who came to Mount Vernon in 1805 and noted that Will, quote, "inquired of me very earnestly after Lord Cornwallis," end quote, his former enemy. Like Darby Vassall, Will Billy Lee apparently also chose to be buried near the grave of his former master. According to Mary Thompson, there is, quote, "a Mount Vernon tradition that he was laid to rest in the slave burial ground just a short distance from George Washington's tomb," end quote. Since he was a free man at the time of his death, this was clearly a decision he made on his own. George Washington at Harvard. This is a story about so much more than the briefest of conversations between the father of our country and a little six-year-old boy. The story was missed or perhaps ignored because it does not fit a preconceived mindset, a mindset bathed in what comes down to being a fundamental intellectual rejection of America's founding. This does not mean that the Harvard Report's authors are all radical leftists, but they have certainly been influenced by the times and by that mindset. Sadly, this is taking all of us down on a very downward trajectory. To keep their new revolution going, radical leftists must continually stir up racial strife and other hatreds to further divide America. The most woke among them are obsessed with thoughts of radical change by tearing America down. This is part of their great reset of society. At this point in time, they have nothing but contempt for the words and philosophy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and King's commitment to peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience in the face of true prejudice and discrimination. They do not heed his words, quote, "continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive," end quote. Or the person who said, quote, "we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation," end quote. Truth be told, they would be tearing down Martin Luther King statues now too, if it served their purposes. What they continually hammer away at is the central paradox. How could men supposedly devoted to liberty also espouse keeping slaves or otherwise countenance the institution of slavery? It's true, this is a deep paradox, and there's no simple answer to that question that does not appear hypocritical to 21st century sensitivities. To merely say that slavery was deeply intertwined in society and took a long while, along with its after effects, to be unwound, along with racial discrimination, seems wholly unsatisfactory and self-serving. But America was always an idea and an ideal that was in development. It wasn't fully formed from the very beginning. However, radical leftists today don't really care about any explanation beyond their essentially neo-Marxist worldview. They search out and emphasize whatever contradictions they can find from the past, or even make up new ones in some cases. They judge the past by the standards of the present. In doing so, they perpetuate the worst possible stereotypes and revel in them. The glass is always half empty, never half full. They, however, have become the new racists, since everything to them is about race. They have built up a false image of alleged white supremacy because they hate America. They want to tear that America down, not bind up its wounds. They are haters, first and foremost, who do not believe in forgiveness and redemption. They want to burn this country down, to continue to stir up division at every opportunity, and to throw America away as they seek to build their new globalist dystopia. We cannot allow them to succeed. But there's something deeper, and to understand that is to understand more of what America really is, not the pseudo-American monstrosity created by those who hate our founding. This deeper essence is at the heartbeat of who we are as a people and as a nation. We are going through so many of our troubles now because we have forgotten who we are, and others are trying to rewrite the script. It is rather the answer of President Abraham Lincoln, who, in memorializing the deaths of so many who died to end slavery and to hold the Union together, reaffirmed in the Gettysburg Address that this country was founded on a proposition, that is, that all men are indeed created equal, and that this nation was conceived in liberty. As a nation, we did not always live up to that proposition, but that was the promise. That was the promise for which so many gave their lives. They did not decide to give up on America because some of our founders started out as slave owners. As Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke in his famous 1963 speech, I Have a Dream, quote, "When the architects of our great republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," end quote. And with that promise came a duty that we as Americans, to once again quote Abraham Lincoln, should take increased devotion to that cause for which those who died gave the last full measure of devotion, that those honored dead should not have died in vain, but that under God, this nation should have a new birth of freedom. Today, we desperately need that new American birth of freedom. Telling these stories is a good place to begin. This is A.J. Melnick for EarlyHarvard.com.